I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Tom Wayman joins me again. He's recently published a new collection of poetry, Out of the Ordinary. He's a marvelous writer, and this new collection showcases Wayman's skill at putting words together in poetry that's playful and challenging, as well as illustrative and opaque. There are poems that are amusing as well as deeply profound as Tom dismantles misuse of language, especially when willfully mendacious. Tom has the ability to observe life and the things around us so carefully, sometimes admiringly and lovingly, that it's a perspective that's not only welcome but inspiring. There are poems in this collection that describe what it might be like to get into a seed or a raindrop, that make the reader want to see the world as Tom does. There are poems in this collection that also examine grief and friendship, and poems and the poems that contend with the loss of a friend are instructive as to how to work through grief, but also present his late friend honestly. Tom Wayman is the author of more than 20 previous collections of poetry, 3 collections of critical and cultural essays, 3 books of short fiction, and a novel. He was the 2022 recipient of the George Woodcock Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Literary Arts. In 2015, he was named a Vancouver Literary Landmark with a plaque on Commercial Drive commemorating his championing of people writing for themselves about their daily employment. He first appeared on the program last year when his memoir, The Road to Appledore, or How I Went Back to the Land Without Ever Having Lived There in the First Place, was published. There is an event Thursday evening, the 8th of May, at Iron Dog Books. Tom and Nick Thran will be reading from their books. Visit tomwayman.com for more. This new collection is from Harbor Publishing. We spoke 2 weeks ago with Tom joining me from his home in Winlaw, British Columbia. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Tom Wayman. Mr. Wayman, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you very much for having me back.
Nice to talk to you again. I was just telling you before we started how much I'm enjoying this collection. I went and reread parts of it last night. And the thing that I get as I'm reading your collection, Out of the Ordinary, is that there is a reverence for language here on your part. Can you remember, Tom, when you came to love words and how you realized you could use them in all sorts of artistic ways?
I can tell you exactly. When I was quite young, you know, I was quite involved with the Boy Scout movement, and this was in northern BC. I lived in Prince Rupert, grew up in Prince Rupert, and a guy took us, one of the fathers of one of my good friends took myself and a couple other kids camping, and we went up to Skeena to an area near Hazelton and camped there, and this guy had thought of these awards for these tasks that he set us, building fires and, you know, just all the usual outdoor stuff.
Yeah.
But I didn't do real well on any of those, so he invented, because we were that area, there's a number of dairy farms, so he invented a special award for me called the Cow Pie Scribe because of stories I told. And so that's when I kind of thought, oh, there's something in this thing of dealing with words, the occasional award here.
Yeah, yeah. There's also, as I mentioned, this reverence, but you also have this playfulness about your writing. You use words in such a way that you create often fantastic images for the reader. Do you have fun writing? I mean, writing seems, it's a job for you and for a lot of people, but than not, do you find that it can be fun for you?
Yes, it's mostly fun for me. I know a lot of people, excuse me, I know a lot of people that have problems with writing, like writer's block.
Sure.
They can always find something else to do rather than sit down and write. But I actually look forward to it. I've never lacked, I mean, knock wood, I've never lacked things that I want to put down in writing. And I'm often surprised, you know, when I do start writing, what the words do, what the language does, that I wasn't expecting. And then in rewriting, again, I can come back to something and it retains, the language retains a spark, or it almost shows me a better way to phrase something. and that interaction is just something, that interaction with words is just something I really enjoy. It spills over into other parts of my life too, like writing, you know, press releases for events or editing, you know, friends writing in some way or another. But it's all fun for me. I think if you do it long enough, you get a kind of self-confidence that the words won't let you down, and then you can just relax and sort of follow what happens.
There's a poem in this collection that laments, well, I shouldn't say that, that talks about how certain words have changed meaning over the years, and not necessarily for the good sometimes. What do you make of how language evolves? I mean, you know, you've written for a very long time. You've read for a very long time. You listen to how others read and write. What do you make of, because you also, there's also an indictment in the book about sort of corporate tech speak, you know, a corruption of say, meanings of certain words. I mean, language does evolve, doesn't it? But I mean, does it evolve too much, say?
No, I don't think so. I mean, people are always praising English as a language because it's not static. It constantly changes. People invent words. When I was young in the 60s, a lot of the changing vocabulary came from Black English, where there was a kind of energy in how words were being used. And you're right that sort of against those kinds of changes, which often can make the language more exciting, more vivid, there's all that corporate speak, yes, where like in our area, nobody does logging; it's always fiber extraction, stuff like that. Where it's just pitiful in a way, but they feel compelled to do it. You know, your call is important to us. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
Those kinds of phrases and terms, which people know are phony, but it's part of the atmosphere of language that we move in is both, you know, a pull to make it, you know, more exciting, more energetic, and one to be to obscure reality, to just send out a big cloud of deodorant to try to make it something awful smell better. So words are not neutral. They can be used sort of for good or ill, and I think writers kind of have to be aware of both those poles, and then your own vocabulary, has its limitations, and so you try to stay alert to how other people are using the language. Like you said just now, that you do a lot of reading as well as a lot of writing, and in part that's to see what works and what doesn't in terms of how other people are using the same medium you're using to create. And I should say, in defense of language, if that sounds like I'm being negative, that I taught for a while in the art school here in Nelson, and I was very impressed by how every medium, like if you're working in clay, has its advantages and disadvantages, has things that are good about it and things that are not. And so the material that we make art out of, language is no really different than clay or if you're working in the fiber arts, you know, different kinds of materials have advantages and disadvantages, that sort of thing.
So for you and for a lot of writers, it's a solitary experience. What is it like when you write something that's I'm talking about a poem now, when you feel that it's done? Or something that you particularly like. I mean, how do you find yourself in that moment at your desk celebrating, sir?
Well, yeah. I mean, the trouble with being too excited about what I write, thinking, you know, this is a work of staggering genius, is that when I look at it the next day, even, I can often see problems with it that I couldn't see in that moment of kind of euphoria. You learn to be more cautious, that I've been working on a series of poems about various things, and I've really been enjoying that, and every time I finish, I just think, God, this is so good. But then I go back to it 2 days, 3 days, a week or two later, and it stopped being a work of genius. Mm. And then even when I finally decide that I have it perfect and send it out to the waiting world, that whole process of trying to get things published is just a huge amount of rejection. And then that's very sobering. So, because, of course, people have different aesthetics. Like my sense of a piece of writing that's marvelous is not necessarily that of an editor. Everybody brings their own experiences and sense of what they want, say, poetry to do. Mm-hmm. They bring that to their reading. And so just because of living in a world of changing, a changing sense of the value of what I'm writing, I've just learned to not get too excited about something, even though in the moment I think it's done, it's finished, it's wonderful.
Yeah, there is a piece in the book about talking, where you talk about rejection, it's a piece of a poem about, say, submitting to the New Yorker and
yes.
getting
yeah.
rejected. Which is probably a reason why I, as interested as I am in writing, I've never done it at all, because I would hate to have to go through that time and time again.
Yes.
When you would think that the thing that you just wrote was the greatest thing, ever.
It's really a part of I think any artist. I mean, again, if you were a potter and you're making cups, say, and then, you know, you take either the physical cups or photographs of them around to galleries, and someone says, nah, you know, we got lots of cups. Or,
sure.
It's just part of the art world. But it does discourage people. Like, I'm forever telling students and former students, perseverance is probably more important than talent. That if you believe in your writing, you just have to persevere through that forest of rejection, because it's a part of all the arts. It's not only writing, but it's too bad that it does stop people from writing, and it does stop people who I think write extremely well. It stops them often from sending out, trying to get published.
What role does the editor have in terms of, say, your work, especially the work in this collection? Do you find that their input changes things that you've written? And I'm just curious to know how much, say.
Well, I've never had really, I've rarely had good results from editors. Because of a different aesthetic. So, especially with poems, I'm pretty sure, I have a lot of confidence that what I write may not be for everybody, but it's done. It's right for me. And so when books of mine have been edited, they don't change that much. Occasionally an editor will point out something, but I tend more to self-edit, using often time to give you the distance on the work. A good editor can be helpful in the sense of showing you a way of reading something that you hadn't thought of, because in your mind it can only be read one way, but they can show you a different way that you may not want, and often some small changes can make a big difference in making sure that the piece is read the way you intended. I know that there's stories of authors who were greatly helped by editors. There's that movie, The Genius,
mm-hmm.
which is about Maxwell Perkins and Thomas Wolfe,
yeah.
which is a really good movie for showing that. You wouldn't think the editing process would make a good movie, but
yeah.
I certainly recommend it, because he was able to take, a fairly incoherent, that is Maxwell Perkins, take a fairly incoherent mass of writing and really carve some great books out of it. Yeah. But that's kind of not how I write. So editing has had less impact on me, let's put it, had less impact on my writing than it might for other people.
There's a poem in this collection where you talk about, I'll preface this by, I have poets on this program from time to time. And one of the things I've always said is that growing up I never liked poetry. You talk about how when people say that they don't explain what kind of poetry they don't like or why they don't like poetry, which I think is important because there's so, as you point out, just a great variety of poetry out there. I guess it's when people say that, and when I've said that over the years that I don't like poetry, it's because I guess I wasn't taught how to appreciate it
well enough,
you know?
It's been a problem because it's mostly because in school, you know, as I say, poetry is kind of an instrument of torture, and often there's some wonderful teachers of poetry, but most people's experience is it's bad, bad, bad.
Yeah.
That they're showing poems that they don't have purchase on and so on. The American poet, Billy Collins, is very aware of this. And when he was the American Poet Laureate, he tried to turn that around. So he found 180 poems that he thought would work well in high school and published an anthology called Poetry 180, partly because he wanted to turn things around 180 degrees about people. It's not just that they dislike poetry. They hate it, is what they'll tell you. And he really wanted to change that around. There's also turns out to be 180 teaching days in the American secondary school year, so it all worked out. Mm. And that was quite successful in at least giving those teachers who cared poems that high school students could really relate to. And they were good poems. It wasn't... You know, it wasn't sort of lowest common denominator stuff. He said that why a lot of poets turn people off poetry is, he says, it's like they build a house but they don't install a door. That is, there's no access to what they're saying, and he feels that wrong. They expect people to climb in through the window, he says. Yeah. Of course, people don't want to do that, To me, it's no different than music. There's just dozens and dozens of kinds of music, including, you know, atonal music, what they call new music, which includes people coughing and doors shutting and stuff. And yet people don't say, I hate music, the way they say, I hate poetry, because they're aware of that there are some kinds of music they love. And I actually think if people were shown a broader range of poetry in school, they would be able to say, I don't like that kind of poetry, but I really do like this. Most adolescents do write poems secretly.
Yeah.
So we know it's a very human drive or initiative, but something happens in those classrooms that kind of turn people off for life.
Yeah, this collection, Out of the Ordinary, is highly accessible. It's very readable. You know, I forget at times that I'm reading poetry as I'm reading this collection because I feel like I'm getting your innermost thoughts, if you will, like that you're committing on the page, not a diary, but I suppose you are working through feelings that you have at the moment, aren't you?
Yeah, that I think that's very astute. I think that in lots of ways there's a real sort of autobiographical thread in what I write. It doesn't mean every poem is, you know, has an I in it, or but it's things that catch my imagination, and therefore there's kind of a personality or a set of attitudes that run through the poems. I think that really is pretty accurate. But as for accessibility, I think there's enough obfuscation of meaning in, for example, the corporate speak that we talked about earlier, that I think writers should try to be as clear as they possibly can in this day and age. I know that's not popular with some of my peers, you know, who kind of want poetry to be difficult and you know, only an elite can really penetrate the deep meaning that's in it and all that stuff. But I read a lot of popular science, cosmology, and some of the new discoveries about the ocean and so on. And I find those scientists can take incredibly complex ideas and present them in ways that can communicate to someone like me, you know, who's not a peer of theirs. And I really admire that. And I think, why on earth, when there's so many problems that are difficult on the planet, would you want to write in a way that adds one more difficulty to people's lives? So it's a choice I make, but it, like I say, it's not all that popular among people with a different aesthetic about poetry. For example, I begin each section, there's six sections in Out of the Ordinary, the new book, and I begin each one with a prose statement where I try to explain, you know, what I'm doing, why these poems are grouped here. And you talked about editors earlier. An editor that I had for this collection that the publisher had hired really objected to the idea of explaining to people what you're doing. He just felt, you know, this kind of undermined what poets do. But on the other hand, I've had lots of feedback from people, as I told him, that they really liked this this prose introduction to the poems. And for one thing, I think it helps show the difference, without making a big deal of it, between prose and poetry.
Yeah, yeah. It does, because then it also shows us that, you know, it's sort of like, I hate to put it this way, like a menu of what's to come and what we might expect. But yeah. But in a way, the other thing it does is it shows, you know, you're telling us something at the beginning of each section, but then as we read each poem, the feeling that I got is that you're telling us things about yourself that you probably wouldn't tell us, say, if I asked you questions about certain aspects of your life in an interview. There is that sort of sharing, if you will, that happens in a poem that doesn't happen in any other kind of, say, interaction with another person.
Yes, yeah, I think that's true. Like, for example, in one section here, I try to imaginatively enter a number of objects to see what's in there, like a nail or a carrot seed or the wind or grass, and that's not something I would admit to thinking about. You know, in conversation with friends, they think I was kind of nutty.
Speaking of, you mentioned a carrot seed. One of the great lessons I took away from the book is that there is so much beauty around us, and that we need, a lot of us need to see that. And there's a lot of things that we overlook. In, say, a grain or a seed or a blade of grass. Have you always had that ability to say, look beyond whatever it is and try to get into whatever it is you're seeing? I mean, and I kept wondering as I was thinking about that as I finished the collection, that do you think that's empathy, say?
Okay, so two questions. One is, like, have I always been able to do this? And I think the answer is no. I think it grew from, you know, having moved out here in 1989 to southeastern BC to living in a rural area where you do get those constant hits of beauty, and every day there's something. A flower opens, a bird comes by, a mountain changes color and a different light. And because you're constantly aware of that, it becomes part of every day, and so you kind of look for it, I guess, is the short answer. I know when I'm in the city, because I'm back and forth to Vancouver a fair bit, it's very exciting to be in the city, and it's like a different landscape. But in a way, there isn't the time or the pause in the everyday that we get in the country to savor, to appreciate a little hit of beauty that cumulatively makes for quite a pleasant life. The question is it empathy? Yeah, that's a good one. I don't really know. I don't know how much of it is projection. After all, I've often puzzled, like, why do we find certain things beautiful? Like why is a snow-covered street or hillside, why is that? Like, what is it about it that makes it beautiful? Why are flowers beautiful? And I don't really have an answer for that, other than I think we're kind of hardwired through whatever evolutionary process brought us down from the trees and into sort of a society. We're somehow programmed to see certain things as beautiful, and it's a bit of a mystery still to me. So I don't really know if it's empathy as much as just a response that's somehow deep in everybody, really, whether we get a chance to practice it or not.
You know, as you were just speaking, I was thinking about the use of the word empathy as I did in the question. I guess I've sort of conflated as after I've read this collection, empathy with curiosity. And I guess those are two qualities that I like, that I would like for myself. but I admire in people. And I think I got both in this collection from you.
If I can say so, Joe, you have both of those. Just doing the podcast, like, if you weren't curious about people and writing, you wouldn't do the podcast. And obviously, you have a lot of empathy because you do respond to what people have written and ask really intelligent questions about it. You can't do that without that combination, which I kind of like your formulation of that combination of curiosity and empathy, or empathy and curiosity.
Well, I think we all work at it, and I work at it every day, and I probably fail more days than not. But as I said, those are qualities that I really admire about the writing that I'm reading in Out of the Ordinary that I've been, I guess, contending with. And the other thing that I've been thinking about as I finish the collection is you talk about, you reflect on a friend of yours that died, and there's a section in the book that talk about Dennis, I forgot.
Dennis Sala.
Yeah, he died in November of 2020, and you've written a number of poems about him in the aftermath of his death. On those poems, did you write those in response to say, to trying to understand the loss in your life?
Yes, yeah, no, very much. It's Dennis was both a really difficult person and also one that, like, I'd known for over 50 years, and someone who read more carefully than I did, and had some real insights into writing. So I always enjoyed. He lived in the Monterey area of California, and so I didn't see him all that often. But there was an awful lot of phone calls back and forth, and over the years we did a few road trips and so on. And I had been close to him for quite a long time. I was actually there when he proposed to his wife, if you can believe that. Mm. So we'd been through an awful lot together, and I knew him and his kids and their kids and so on. So his loss, which was extremely sudden, it was a brain bleed that just suddenly happened, and there was no indication that it was going to happen, and it was deep enough in the brain that they just couldn't do anything. But his loss came at a time in life where other people that I've known for a long time are disappearing. There's an elegy in the book to one of the kind of labor activists around Vancouver, Gordy Larkin. Mm. There's an elegy in the book to one of the poets that I've been friends with for years from Toronto, Pier Giorgio De Chico. It's just that time of life for me where people are winking out. But with Dennis, because of his connection with poetry particularly, and his connection to California and all those dimensions to our friendship, one after another those poems appeared, and until it became like a sequence, and so you're sort of mourning the loss of a person, but also obviously of a future, that is of more good times or learning more things that you know from the person, that sort of thing.
Did the process of writing the series of poems did it help with the grief that you were feeling?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess so, but it's important always to remember that I think words can do a lot, but they're just words. I've always had a lot of trouble with feeling. In that memoir, The Road to Appledore, I describe a sequence working with a counselor who's trying to get out of me how I feel about a certain event. I don't know that that sense of loss, for example, disappeared because I had written these poems, but it certainly helped me get a perspective on it, I guess would be the best thing to say. I feel better for having written them, but that loss still exists, and I have a picture of him up in my study, so I certainly think about him every day. As I have some pictures up of other good friends that I've lost, in order to sort of keep them in my everyday thinking. It doesn't ever go away. I don't think people get over it or get past it or it just changes, and writing, helps that change for the better.
There's a beautiful line in one of the poems in the collection. You talk about the impoverishments of your life brought about by time. And that hit for me as I was reading the collection, because then, the stream of memories that I have of people that I've lost in my life come back as I'm reading, whatever poem it is I'm reading at the moment in Out of the Ordinary.
One friend of mine pointed out, he said, after a certain point in life, you can't make any new old friends.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, is that ever true? I mean, you make new friends, but they're never going to be people that you knew for, 40 or 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask about that because, that's the other thing that I was thinking about, is that that's one of the things that a lot of people hate about getting older, is that it's hard to make new friends.
Yeah, I think that's true. Especially if you're not working, because there's a big social aspect to work, and although you don't make friends on every job, there's lots of jobs where because you've been through certain experiences together, you make really good friends. But the moment that you're not employed, there's substitutes like different kinds of clubs and outings and organizations of one kind or another, but it's different than sort of seeing people every day the way you do, when you're in school, or the way you do, when you're on a job. It becomes harder. It's something you notice in this area because this is a big retirement area. So people have left a network of friends and connections, say in the Lower Mainland, and have moved up to this area because, they can sell their house down there and buy a really nice place up here and still have a bag of gold left over. But then they're faced with trying to make friends. So it's definitely an issue. Let's put it that way. And even if you stay in one place, then aging, takes away people that were important.
I turned 43 recently, and these are things that I've been thinking about, obviously I've missed old friends that have since passed away as well over the years, and you remember. I was going to ask you about the afterlife, and I don't hold much stock in anything happening after we pass away, but this idea of an afterlife living on in people's memories, I think, is comforting to me. And
yeah,
I think
that's
probably a better afterlife than, say, whatever might be beyond the stars, if you will.
Yeah. No, about all I'm sure about the afterlife is that it won't be the way religions describe it.
Mm.
because they seem wrong on just about everything else. So I don't imagine they got this one right either. If such a thing exists, but yeah, I think the afterlife in imagination, though, is important, and that can include exactly what you say, like how we remember people and hopefully being remembered ourselves at least briefly.
Yeah.
And but also as a kind of mirror of everyday life, how we picture the afterlife tells a lot about how we're thinking about the life we're living now.
Exactly.
I have that poem in this collection called Economic Practices on Earth Affect the Inhabitants of Heaven, which is kind of like trying to wrestle with the idea of, you know, if there was a perfect place for you, you know, what would it be like? And in a way, that's thinking about changes that we need here on the planet while we're still alive.
I wrote down the word regret as I was reading the collection, I can't think of a specific poem where this comes up, but this is a feeling that I had as I was reading, I guess, and that's why I wrote the word down. Where are you on regret, and how do you contend with that? Because I think that's something that a lot of people, it can ruin a lot of people's lives when they think of what might have been or what they should have done, say, as they look back at moments in their life. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, the question of regret, I think by and large the 21st century is, you could call it the century of regret, because
yeah.
the kinds of changes that have happened since 2001 have all been bad. Like it's hard to think of a single institution that's gotten better in that time. And I mean, whether it's writing and publishing or whether it's politics or whether it's, I mean, you name it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's advances in science and medicine, but you know, you have to offset that with suddenly, you know, people can't find a doctor, people can't, get access to the kind of new discoveries and so on. So that's one issue. So if the book seems to have a kind of subtext of regret, I think you can make a case that virtually every 21st century book has that. How to deal with it, though? The only way I know to offset it is what you were mentioning earlier, which is to appreciate the beauty where we can find it in our lives. Whatever brings people joy and a sense of awe is vital, and maybe never has been so vital as it is in the 21st century, and maybe since January especially.
Yeah.
But I have friends that are quite in despair about so many changes for the worst in so many aspects of their lives. And, I don't know what to say other than to look for things that are beautiful or that bring joy and really treasure those. They might be ephemeral, they might be, you know, fast disappearing, but at least while they're still here, that appreciation, to me anyway, offsets regret for the kinds of changes that have made people's lives worse, not better this century.
Yeah, as I said earlier, that's one of the great lessons I got out of the book, is that there's so much around us that good and bad. Let's look at something, you know, that's good that's around us and maybe focus on that maybe and... I guess it just makes the day a little bit better, you know?
Yeah, it's not that you shouldn't stay aware of all the changes that are bad or be thinking about how you and others, you know, might be able to act to, you know, reverse some of these changes. But in addition to that, like, that can't be the whole thing that you think about. Because otherwise it's like you're trying to build a new world without a vision of where you're going. And if we want a world that's full of beauty and joy, we need to really think about, you know, what brings us beauty and joy. Otherwise, the drive for a better world just becomes bogged down in organizations that kind of mirror all the bad stuff that's happening, we're completely right, you're completely wrong, and away we go. It's I think vital to know, you know, what kind of world you want there to be, and that takes some thinking. It's not just you know, automatically obvious.
Yeah.
It can't just be the negative, like, I don't want this to happen, I don't want that to happen. That's not enough to go on to strive towards a better world.
Before I let you go, Tom, I always wanted to know this. The drive from, say, Winlaw to Vancouver, how long is that?
Well, it depends how fast you drive.
Mm.
It takes me about, from Winlaw, you know, stopping for coffee and lunch and stuff, it takes me about 9 hours.
I see. Yeah. How many stops would you make, say?
Pardon me?
How many stops would you make along the way?
Well, I stop in Castlegar, which is about 45 minutes for some breakfast, and then I stop in a Soyuz, which is about another couple hours for lunch, and then just punch it through. Sometimes I'll stop in Hope just to catch my breath, sort of after going over the Hope Princeton, which I tend to do rather than the Coquihalla. But I have to say, in defense of that 9 hours, that
yeah.
It has a kind of beauty. You're going through different ecological zones all the time.
Mm.
So, you know, our area and then areas like around the Soyuz, kind of almost desert, the Smilkameen Valley, then the Coast Range through Manning Park. So it's never dull. It has its own beauties. Plus, you're really getting aware of how big British Columbia is, and
I'll
this
bet,
is only
yeah.
the southern, you know, three quarters of it. Which again, when you're living in a city and busy and the city seems everything, you kind of forget how much is out there.
Yeah, I think back to the memoir from last year, and you know, a lot of us want to travel but don't want to go to the United States, for example, or anywhere else for that matter. There's a lot to see in British Columbia, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, there's lots to see in the city too, but
sure.
it's just a sense of largeness that these long drives can give you. And well, even a short drive too, if it's kind of, you know, if you're really paying attention to the difference between sort of different ecologies and therefore the lives of people that live in those different ecologies changing and from what you're used to. And I've always enjoyed driving around for that reason. Very, very different from, you know, air travel where you kind of get on a flying mall and sit there and then presto changeo, you're in some place new, often another city. So it's not that's bad or anything, but it's just different when you're driving.
Tom, I could talk all day with you, and I so appreciate your time today to talk about this collection, because I really enjoyed reading it. Continued good luck with it and everything else. I so appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your enthusiasm for the work. And the chance to talk to you, too.
Well, it's always... let's not wait a year before talking again, okay?
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you so much, Joe.
The website for more is at tomwayman.com. The book is called Out of the Ordinary. It's from Harbor Publishing. It's author Tom Wayman. Join me on the law from Winlaw, B.C. in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.